Hey, everybody.
Hello.
How's it going?
Episode 8.
So
welcome, ladies.
Welcome.
Good to be here.
Hello. It's good to be here.
So we're in the pivotal age of 8, 8th episode, and this is Ruby Woods is our guest, and we also have Mary Lampier, and we're going to be talking about Ron Allen and his legacy in Detroit with a lot of his poetry and plays. And just also how he impacted people's lives. And I'm also going to encourage people to visit vistamaria.org and look into maybe mentoring a girl that's between the ages of 11 and 16. They're put in Vista Maria because their home lives have issues, and a lot of them could use support. So that's something more people should consider doing. But yeah, we'll start with Ruby Woods, who is who has a project all about Ron Allen's legacy that she's working on. Ruby, can you tell us more about that?
Sure. The Ron Allen Project came about in 2015 when another poet and artist was interested in producing one of his plays. And through our conversation, we decided that perhaps making a documentary film about Ron should happen. And so we put out the call, and we had many meetings from 2015 until maybe through 2016, thought about different ways to raise money and get his life story told. And we've had lots of meetings, lots of back and forth, but no money. Last year, however, well, somewhere along the way, I decided to create a page on Facebook, and I simply called it the Ron Allen Project because it's like unformed. And I began to archive anything and everything that I could find about Ron online, or if I was cleaning out spaces and places in my home, I would come across pieces of, you know, maybe an article or a photograph or something. And so I would scan it, and it's all there. And other people have slowly added pieces, but most of what's on that Facebook page, which is simply called the Ron Allen Project, you're welcome to visit it, sign up, and then you will continue to see whatever new things are posted. I really prefer people to post things that refer to Ron and his legacy. But he was a Cass Corridor artist, community minister, sobriety mentor. It's eventually became a Buddhist priest before he moved from this area to California. So Ron's life intersected with so much of the Metro Detroit community. And I first met him when I was invited to perform at the Dally in the Alley. I absolutely do not recall how I ended up getting that invitation. At the time, I was processing personal ritual, and I dared to do it as performance. And so there I was at the Dally in the Alley with a very crude altar of feathers, stones, crystals. I had a crown of feathers on my head, a black and white paper mache mask, and I was puffing on a cigar. And the cigar was basically my tobacco offering just before I decided to perform and come down. When I was gathering things to come downtown, I asked my friend if she had any tobacco, because I knew her father smoked cigars. And so she said, yeah, you know, I'll give you one of my dad's cigars. So instead of breaking down the tobacco, I just puffed on the cigar as I was reciting some very personal things and did a little singing and chanting. But Ron came down the alley and he saw Ruby doing this thing, and he just stopped in his tracks. And when I was done, he came over and he talked to me, he wanted to know about me, wanted to know where I was from. And I can only imagine that his first thought was that, okay, I got to check my meds because I'm hallucinating. I don't know what this is going on at the Dally, but I need to find out. And from that day forward, he began to call me and call me and call me on a daily basis. And I was not sure what that meant, but because of Ron's energy, I didn't feel like, okay, there's craziness happening. I didn't feel that I was in any danger of cultivating a relationship with him. And it just continued on through more of my expressing as Ruby, and then deciding to have children and kind of putting Ruby to the side. But Ron really did not allow me to put Ruby to the side, because Ruby is a pseudonym that I adopted when I began to do the ritual performance. And so I know that the power of his work with so many people has shaped the lives of many artists coming out of the Cass Corridor in the Detroit metro area and beyond. And so it's important that I do my best to not allow his legacy to just go by the wayside and be forgotten. So that's why I maintain the page. And recently, we've actually been getting some interviews recorded. And we'll just keep moving until we have more of a completed project. My vision is to do an installation project that would include video and still photography and live readings of his work, other folks' work, perhaps poems that were inspired by Ron, but also readings of scenes from some of his plays.
Yeah, so how did you meet Ron, Mary?
Well, I first met Ron back in the 70s. There was a place called the Freezer Theater down by down in the Cass Corridor that was actually in an old freezer. And we were doing poetry and performance art and things like that. And the slogan of the Freezer Theater was, "The freezer is hot." And one day somebody firebombed it. And that was the end of the freezer in that location. And I moved on to other things. Ron was going through his things. We didn't see each other for years. And then, if you believe in fated meetings, someone gave me a blue stone, which I lost. And Sarah Adaye had a party, and her husband at the time had found my blue stone and put it on top of tall fish tank.
That's crazy.
And I was standing next to that fish tank, and Ron was at that party, and something jiggled, and the blue stone landed in my drink.
Whoa.
And Ron saw that, and you know how Ron was, attracted to anything unusual. We got in this huge conversation. We talked the rest of the night. He invited me down for one of his poetry workshops.
Horizons of Poetry, right?
No, it was actually a thing he was doing at the UU Church as kind of a class. But it was like bring in people who wanted to be poets or maybe wanted to learn about poetry. And I get these intuitions. Ron and I had a very intuitive connection. And I said, we're meant to do something together. So I walked into that class, and I had a poem that was pretty much like a Ron Allen poem. We wrote a lot. We wrote very similarly. And I laid it on the table and I said, here. And he read it and he was like, and that started a 12-year collaboration.
Wow.
Totally. He was probably like, I don't have to free up this one. She's already free.
No, that was about where it was at. Yeah. But, you know, we provoked each other. We pushed each other hard. And I think that was kind of the basis of our friendship for all those years.
I think he really liked like people that had their own energy, that like how he came upon you. It was probably just such a sight and so surreal, but he just lived in the moment, like within what you were saying, how he just talked about that stone falling and just had like a in the moment kind of conversation about this, like how surreal that was.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I met him too. I was just walking by the Unitarian Church. I was 19. I was at Wayne State. And he just started talking to me. And from there, I mean, we just kind of started hanging out weekly, going to restaurants, because you know how his love of food.
Mm-hmm.
He was a cook.
Yeah.
He was a chef. Yeah.
At Cass Cafe. And before that, it was Cosmic Cafe, which I only went to that a few times because I would hang out like in Detroit a lot during high school, but you know, I think that place closed early.
I remember I used to go to Cosmic Cafe,
kind of on the early side.
Well, the
night.
Other
but it was good.
Very powerful thing about Ron for me is that he had an incredible mental capacity, and he was schizophrenic, but he was so self-aware, and he was always modifying his meds. You know, he would go to the doctors and let them know, this is going on, that's going on. Whereas most people, you get your script, you just take it, and all kinds of side effects and shit happen to you, and you're just living with it. But Ron was like immediately, okay, this is doing something different, and it's not what I want. So he was always on it. And I believe that part of the phone calls that he would make so much to people and his poetry, and then subsequently the plays. When I first met him, he was not writing plays. But those voices helped him displace the schizophrenic voices. And he had some measure of control over the voices of the people he would talk to on a daily basis, and then in turn process it in
it was
either
a creative way of
poetry
reassurance. Yeah,
or
totally.
A scene. I believe it was a way of him self-medicating.
Oh, okay.
Without pharmaceuticals.
And making sure that his creative voice and mental acuity was still sharp, because that's like a really cool way to that you know your capacities are sharp. Yeah, if you keep in contact with a bunch of friends and people, then you know there's no question.
Sure.
Instead of just vegging out.
Yeah.
Then you don't know where you're at. Right.
Well, then you're going down the dark corridors all by yourself, and that's right. A whole different experience.
And we also want to talk about, definitely, I think, how Ron was very much ahead of his time as far as being very like he've definitely interacted with a lot of people, like phone calls, planning different event plays in his readings, Horizons in Poetry. It would be interesting if he was still alive, how he would have adapted to the age we're in now.
He would be in heaven, because the scenes that he created for his plays, nobody was having video screens all over the place or static, like, you know, in a voice coming from here or there. Or one time he did a poem at Cass Cafe, a poetry reading, and one of the poems involved a gun. And there was a woman who actually wanted to sue him because she didn't realize, like, when the poem began to be performed. This was kind of like maybe his first beginning to create scenes. And so he had like a few actors in the seat, in the setting, and they began to speak the words, and someone had a gun. And she really kind of freaked out. She didn't realize this was part of his performance art, you know. He was able to, like, speak with her and help her understand. I'm sorry.
So she found it very jarring.
Yes. And so the ability now to use digital layering or voiceovers or, you know, holograms, all of those things now, Ron would just be on it.
Yeah, I miss my weekly outings with him. We go to Soup Kitchen, Saloon, or, you know, just go see a play or go to Belle Isle or lots of different restaurants. Mm-hmm. And he did like to go out dancing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. He loved to dance.
Oh, yes.
Right.
And that's the one place where we had a bit of a departure. Even though I love to dance, I like to solo dance, but Ron loved the old school bopping and social dancing and, you know, mm-hmm. With the right partner. I love to watch him dance, but I have always had difficulty being led. And so I don't do partner dancing, you know.
Yeah, I'm kind of a wild dancer myself. That's my style, right? Totally. I take up a lot of dance floor.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
Well, Ron had a deep romantic side to him.
Oh, yes. Know?
He loved women. He had many female friends. He nurtured women. And that was one of the great things about Ron.
I can say for sure that my most intimate relationship in my lifetime was the years that I was in relationship with Ron. He and I talked about all manner of things, you know, whether I had this lover or that one, you know, and I've talked to Ron about things that I didn't even speak to the women that I knew about, you know. There was just an openness there. And he's the one who first pointed out to me that I was actually writing songs at a certain point, because offhandedly I said, well, you know, songwriting is like poetry. And he says, no, it's not.
Yeah, there are differences.
Very clear. It's like, no, it's not. And you can take poems and make them into songs, or you can take songs and make them into poems, but they're really not the same. And so I actually started looking at some of the things that I had written that I considered poems, and they subsequently revealed themselves to me as songs.
Is that where your opera, as I call it, came out of?
The Excarnation.
Yes,
of
the
Ruby
Excarnation
Woods.
Of Ruby
Woods. Yes,
that was
a big collaboration that I did with Ron and many others. But it also coincided with the year I was turning 50, and I had this idea that it came the year after I turned 50. Because the year I turned 50, I did a ritual that Ron facilitated for me, and I created a mock funeral for myself and invited people. And when they arrived, I was like already covered and on this table as if it was like a funeral shroud. And I had a whole program written, but the key part was that Ron was supposed to ask everybody to express how they met me, what their relationship to me meant, and then to say what they felt were my strengths and weaknesses. And my dear Ron, he was so excited about the ritual that he ended up forgetting to ask them that key piece, because I really kind of wanted to hear what people thought were my strengths and weaknesses. But
yeah, because that's a unique chance and opportunity that really doesn't present itself till, you know, the inedible happens.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so we completed the ritual, and the year after that is when many things changed in my life, and I came up with the idea of doing a ritual concert on the summer solstice, and it was called The Excarnation of Ruby Woods. And where I heard the term excarnation was actually at a menopause workshop that was being hosted by a woman who studied anthroposophy, which is the study of the spirit of man, woman. And Rudolf Steiner believes that we incarnate gradually and then we gradually excarnate. So I was thinking, okay, 50 years, I'm halfway there. Now I'm excarnating. I'm on my way out. And that's where the title of the concerts came from, because I did four concerts in the year 2004. And we began on the summer solstice, and the last one ended on the winter solstice. But most of the songs in the concert were my songs. But we did Goddess Chants, and then there were a couple original songs from two of the vocalists, and two folk songs that were featured in the concert.
Where was this done at? That must have, I don't remember that in my peripheral. Where
we did it first at First Church, and it was a ritual from start to finish. Ron actually rang the bells as an invocation, and then we sang the four directions. While we were doing that, there was a woman doing Tai Chi on the stage, but the performers, the vocalists, we were in the four corners of the room. And then we came forward one at a time to kind of introduce each of our voices. And then we began to sing together.
And there's four seasons, so maybe that's...
It was mainly the four directions that I was dealing with, or the elements, earth, air, fire, water.
Yeah,
we were singing the elements in. Then we did it again at the Birmingham Unitarian Church. That's where I was attending. We did it at the Detroit Waldorf School. That's where my children were attending. And then the fourth and final concert we did at the Karate Dojo in Ferndale. And each time fewer and fewer people attended. However, something very magical happened on that fourth occasion. Because on the first day, my friend Julie Butel, who was one of the vocalists, had arranged for Jer Stormer to record the concert. And I said, well, it's not a concert, it's a ritual, and I don't want it to be recorded. And so that's what we went along, and we chose not to record any of it. But on that winter solstice night, I decided to just bring in a little old school cassette recorder like you would do in a student lecture. And I sat it down by one of the percussionists. And so we had this recording, and I was listening to it with my children after the concerts were all over and everything. We're carpooling to school. And in the middle of the concert, there is something called a vocal meditation, where I would sing Our Deepest Fear by Marianne Williamson, which is, of course, is not a song. It's a passage that she wrote. But I put a melody to it, and I sang it. And then we went into a single word chant of surrender. So when I'm listening to the tape, there was a voice on the tape, and it sounded like me. And it gave me a Bible verse. It said Psalm 119. May your unfailing love come to me, O Lord, your salvation according to your promise. Then I will answer the one who taunts me, for I trust in your word. I will always obey your law forever and ever. I will walk about in freedom, for I've sought out your precepts. I lift up my hands for your commands, which I love, and I meditate on your decrees. And now, I was raised Baptist, but I'm not one who's into the Bible. I own a Bible. And I came home and I looked in my little red Bible from the time that I had as a child, and the words were different. I had to find a different Bible, the International Version, to find those exact words. And the tape actually edited the passage because it's Psalm 119 from 41 to 48, but it edited, and so it skipped over a couple of passages. And so I came home and I wanted to listen to the verses and listen to the tape, because I wrote down the words from this International Version of the Bible, and the tape just chewed itself up. And so I was never able to listen to that again and hear my voice saying those words.
That's a bummer.
But yeah. I own that as a prayer, because as someone, like I said, who didn't study the Bible, and I don't study the Bible, I embrace the Unitarian Universalism. I feel that sacred texts are like that, you know, and so I'm not a literalist when it comes to the Torah or the Quran or the Bible, but I believe individually, if you are open or you create that space to the infinite, it will respond back to you. And that's what came of those concerts.
Those four, yeah. And yeah. That's really something that you had, the ritual when you turned 50 too.
Mm-hmm. It was like it set it up for that next year when the four concerts took place.
And a question where people wanted to know more about what, how did you say anthroposophy?
Anthroposophy.
That's it. How did they learn about that?
Well, Rudolf Steiner.
Being like a website.
Some people feel like he's a very controversial figure. He created the Waldorf pedagogy, and he says that he did it through like spiritual intuition. And basically the difference about Waldorf schools are that they look at developmental stages, but they don't just look at the physical. They look at the spiritual, the emotional, the psychological. And it makes a lot of sense to me, you know, and that's where my children went to school. And there's a lot that the schools fall short of in terms of the ideal, but there's a lot that they should let go, because there are some people who are just very dogmatic about what Steiner had to say.
They take it like kind of literal, and they don't see how you could be flexible, and that everyone's a little different.
Or that things evolve.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I think he would be the first one to say, I'm talking about a pedagogy that supports critical thinking. So if you're going to deal with critical thinkers, things are always going to have to evolve.
And he created it in what year? So
I think in the 20s.
Yeah.
So he would definitely definitely be like, it has to adapt.
Yes. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that just logically. Mary, I was going to ask you, what projects have you worked on, Ron, with?
Well, what we would do is every morning, as soon as one of us woke up, we had a very psychic connection, so we always seemed to know when each other was waking up. We would call each other and talk about whatever was going on. And so I worked on Ron with several of the plays, but the most notable ones were Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was one he wrote when he had to face up to his own mortality, when he was not able to get a kidney transplant, when he was having amputations, when he basically had to face up to the fact that his physical problems were going to lead to the end. And that was when he was going to Still Point and involved in the Dharma Teacher program. And I had gone to a book signing with Robert Thurman, who wrote one version of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. He was the first American Buddhist priest. He's also Uma Thurman's father.
Oh, okay.
So we decided to get a copy of that book and use that as a basis. But it was more like therapy, where he had to look at all the important female relationships in his life and figure out what they meant to his karma and his dharma. And so, as we were talking earlier, I said the working title is The Six Wives of Ron Allen, because Aurora Harris used to always refer to us as his poetry wives. Mm-hmm. And that was the group of women he had around him all the time. You know, we were the ones who fed his soul, and he fed our souls in return. So that was kind of a catharsis for both of us. I mean, when he died, it was very wrenching. When he actually died,
it
was devastating. But that was his way of looking at Ron came from a very poverty-influenced background. He grew up on the east side of Detroit. His father died when he was young. His mother was schizophrenic. They had nothing. When Ron was 17, his mother was institutionalized, and he went off to Vietnam, and the other children were taken in by other people. And the Vietnam experience greatly influenced his life. One, it introduced him to drugs. Two, it probably triggered his schizophrenia. But it also brought him into a consciousness that he probably wouldn't have had if he was in the middle of war. It's also where he learned to cook. So that was a huge influence, but he had to keep processing that. You know, you'll see that throughout his plays. You know, he's talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. He's talking about the psychic damage that can be caused by war. But also he talks about the psychic healing that can be brought with love. And that's, I think, where a lot of us, his female friends, came in. Because he was such an open person, he could allow you to love and be loved. Mm-hmm. And like what Ruby was saying, you could talk to him about anything, and that's what he liked. That's what he mined. And that's what his plays were about, were opening up the soul. So they were not conventional plays.
He had quite a way with words, too.
Yeah.
And the sound of words, the really poetic flow, you know.
Well, part of the process was getting the beat of the play. And a lot of times we would turn on Electric Era Miles Davis, like Bitches Brew, and that would be the beat of a play. And
I can see that.
Yeah, I know you can see that. But one of the reasons he used poetry in the plays was poetry and the metaphor of poetry opens up a part of the subconscious that just plain flat words will not. And he also worked with actors who really enjoyed that process, who would bring their own life experiences. Ron did not deal with people who had to be whitewashed. He did not deal with, you know, the straight and narrow. He had people who had a lot of life experiences that people would consider scary. And he put them out on the table and out on the stage and let them breathe air and let them heal.
And that's why he did a lot of his community work, like with cots. Right. And, you know, he taught like all kinds of poetry workshops at shelters. That's why he felt like, I mean, because it feels good to give back, but yet he's always getting ideas from these encounters too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, he and I, you know, I was going along with him. He actually had the gig, was teaching a poetry class at Mariners Inn, which is a residential treatment center for, you know, generally people who don't have men who don't have insurance. And we would go in there, and I remember one time he said, you know, you're probably one of the few white women they have to deal with that isn't on television or isn't, you know, some kind of an authority figure.
That is how he would break it down, too. That's totally right.
And I said, yeah, you're right. So what am I supposed to do? But, you know, we'd go in there and half the guys would be falling asleep or nodding off. And he said, well, they're just observing, you know, observing it the way they have to. And if they need to sleep through us, they need to sleep through us. But the other ones would start coming alive because we would give them a forum where it would break them out of the conventional structures that were keeping them trapped into the lifestyles they were trapped in. Yeah. And that was a big part of the healing of Ron's work was, okay, we tell ourselves a story, or as someone would say, we live in a trance, or we have this structure that we have accepted. Well, break it up. Break open your mind, you know? Say, how do you see that differently? You know, what is this really about? What is the karma here? And that was, you know, the beauty of his work.
Yeah, groundbreaking. And a lot of people haven't had that experience before.
Right.
And it's quite a lot, something to get used to, you know.
And you see that a little bit here or there, you know, and some of the sound, you know, Sounds True is one of those companies that puts out a lot of things that, you know, New Age stuff. I see it here and there. But that questioning and the artistic part, no, that really needs to grow. You know, we need a lot more of that.
Yeah, I wish there was an experimental playhouse in the Detroit area because, well, Ron has 12 plays that we know of. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, all his plays were definitely experimental.
Mm-hmm. And we very saw much
him
so.
And I remember first seeing him read his work at Shadowbox Cafe in mm-hmm. Hamtramck. I bet both of you guys have been there, right?
Mm-hmm. I have not.
Oh.
That's Ruby speaking.
That was like when I was in high school. It was around and it was on Sunday nights. And yeah, he had his very naturalistic style of reading and he would just let the pages fall on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And his poems about women and spices and very rhythmically based. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, he also has a lot of references to body fluids, you know.
Yeah.
There's blood and piss and saliva and, you know, organs and skin and sinews. Those mm-hmm. kinds of things make their way into Ron's poetry.
If you couldn't sweat.
Yes, couldn't. Sweat, tears, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I feel like that because he was so connected to his body, and then that other dimension that intersected with the schizophrenia, that's where I believe he, without really being conscious or about it, that's a way to get into spaces that people don't even realize are openings for them. You know, there's one line I believe in, oh gosh, I don't remember which play it was now. I see the gentleman saying this, but he holds his side and he says, ooh, my liver smells. And with me having like a medical background, I was like, that line was just so like on for the moment, you know, especially considering that the liver is related to the anger in a given body, you know. But for someone to give a line like that to a character in a play, ooh, my liver smells, you know. Only Ron and Alan could pull that off.
Yeah, totally. I mean, have you, and two, we're going to be playing a few of his songs, CDs, and we have a few that we're going to be listening to. But while we were preparing, this also came up in conversation, how Ron was really good at improvising. Like, you could see him read a piece, but he would do it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to take the environment, or maybe you're at a coffee house or somewhere and they have something on the wall, he could incorporate that
mm-hmm.
into the how he would read something. But the name of...
Woman.
Woman.
There's a woman in there.
We're gonna be listening to there's a woman in there, one of his iconic pieces.
It is the real me, opening your head, cutting your cysts. It is the real me leaking poems into your lips, splitting your atoms. You are vinegar sweet with Mars in your eyes. I am brick wet blood. You still searching for the real? Walking up my tongue, claustrophobic in my head. It is the real me coughing you out, choking at poem level. You rise above my saliva, a lion chewing my remains. Didn't know that was a woman in there. 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 Sliding on moon flesh of Eve, dancing fire in the grave of my mouth. I shout hell from God's groin. There's a woman in there. By the vinyl skin avenues, sweat like liquid rage. It is a woman in there. Consumed in my thighs, pepper shaped with bravado. On my upright tongue, fertility winging my hand in the life. There is my death. Dancing in temple chakra spine, boxes of arrhythmia. She growls in a leg of a mess drum. Shakes images of Shakti in the cosmic motion. Didn't know she was in there. Breaking vision in her teeth. Her rotating rhythms revive. Vibrating worship of mantra chant love. She breaks voodoo rites and Celtic revivals. Inebriated hip shake addiction. Poem life rum wings, rooting her thighs with cadence on my altar. There's a woman in there. Watching my faked out, snaked out, made out win. Bracing barred redemption in her laughing ancient abyss. In there, this woman. Crying words of visionary connections of soil and tree. I travel folds of guru sweat. Press warm beer points into my lips. I drink my thirst from a funk. She's in there! Image of dementia dance. Quick loaded guns of mirrors. Quatrains of liquid numbers. It's not mathematics. It's slumberizing. It's us in beds of history. It's spit contained in prisms. She's in there! Rhythm hips of war, smashing my catatonic trance. And dancing my insanity. Yeah, wow, Mary, you can really hear the Miles influence in that one, can't you?
Yep.
Right?
Yes.
You can just almost see him just like on the dance floor.
Well,
right?
Miles was one of his big influences, actually. And he was very good friends with Farouk C. Bey, who also was a big influence on him. Ron had a great deal of interest in ritual and randomness in a Buddhist sense and symbolism. And so he and Farouk would often have what they called the deep talks about, you know, a lot of the esoteric stuff. And I used to work as a tarot reader, and actually the Naked Play, one of his plays, came out of that experience, where one time I had a gig at the Schwitz. And I was joking around about telling people the naked truth and stuff like that. And out of that grew, well, what happens if you take your clothes off? What happens if you fall into an archetype? What happens with this? And it grew into probably one of his most talked about plays.
Yeah, because, yeah, he could see something being told or unfolding in front of him. And, yeah, that's a talent to be able to take that. And say, yeah, you gotta run with that. But we're gonna listen to another song. What's it called?
The Culinary Images of You.
Which reflects his love of food and cooking, too.
Which is going to be, you see, consistent in his work when you listen to it in the future.
Culinary images of split brown sugar mines bitters. Your most men, manner, Mesopotamian breath. Your earth mother and greedy gum of filet of organic okra. Your open oracle of orange, pecan, jasmine, sexuality. Your African plantain, sense of female. Pick an allspice, full and shy. Pick a black forest, shake down rain. Make my toes stand up, chocolate direction. Make my heart burn, fragrances. Make my mind music when bittersweet out my mouth. Make me central energy, making me whole, making me whole, making me whole. You make me music! Your mango melon thighs, your curry almond eyes, licorice murky cumin hair, your regular pubic taste, your corpus current of cosmic toast, making my wet purple, black purple, and your black garlic thighs, your pyramid energy, your entwined lays with the hot region smoked salmon, your three-dimensional humans, hybrid, third world, black chocolate, and new world cocoa, the European hot pepper touch of the cayenne's real word. You make me central space, potassium plethora, jubilant black grape, rhythmic bread pudding, infinite vibration, absolute lot of love, whole wheat yin, curry looking fire, your Reuben onion, got an eggplant, Detroit cornbread, Detroit cornbread, your millet feast, your cookie don't lie on Creole with office of black and orange ruffy. You fill me up, you fill me up, you fill me up with your love.
That was a lot of influence as well. Mm-hmm. Like we were saying, Miles, definitely, I can hear some Parliament in there. And I know he liked the funk.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And you said Ornette Coleman. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I feel like that was like a lovemaking session, you know.
Love it. I remember that one
blast
time.
Of an orgasm.
Somebody told me, said, you know, the way Ron talks about eating a sandwich is the way most guys talk about having an orgasm. So I was like, you nailed him.
I wanted to get back to your project. So if somebody wanted to participate or had any ideas or if they had photos of Ron or something you don't have, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Well, I'm the administrator of the page, so they can just message me.
On
the page, or in Messenger, and if they join, then they have the ability to post anything that they would like to the page. I know at least one person has chosen not to post their photos on the page, but they have told me that they have some photos when we're ready to use them. They'd be willing to share them. So whether it's articles, I was saying to Mary earlier, Metro Times was not digital back in the day, but I'm certain that there's at least one cover of Metro Times that we don't have because it was not digitized. But somebody might have that and it can be scanned.
Yeah, then maybe they can scan it for you, get in the archives.
Yes, and I've also encouraged people to just do their own interview of themselves, you know, with, you can do it with your phone if you have a good phone, but you can use your laptop.
Has some music in the background, and almost, you could almost make it like a poem, but talk about
yes. Mm-hmm. So, since we have all of these tools available now, we should make use of them.
Yeah.
And so, like someone, Sharon Smith Knight, she's out of state, and Satya Kalai, who did the drawings for many of his playbills and for The Unborn Muse of Shadows, which was his book of Buddhist cones that came out of his experience of going to Still Point. She is planning to interview and send us the recording of her personal interview of speaking about working with Ron.
Oh, that's cool. What if some, and if somebody wanted to maybe donate money for the project?
Oh, yes. We have no structure. We don't have a fiduciary or anything like that. However, if we get some money, we have some go-tos that if we needed to set something up, we could get it done.
And when do you think the project will be completed?
We have no idea. Mm-hmm. At this point, the filmmaker right now he's doing the interviews for no money. I did apply to the Culture Source for their little no strings attached $3,000 grant. I'm waiting to hear. I have not received an email back saying no, but you know, wherever we can get some money, we'll take it.
So you hear that, everybody, please get in touch with,
get in touch with Ruby. Yeah. we have to say now on Facebook, my name is Anita Jones. Ruby Woods, as I said earlier, is a pseudonym. Okay. So on Facebook, they need to contact Anita Jones.
Okay.
But we do have the Facebook page, the Ron Allen Project,
yes,
which she's the administrator of.
Yes.
So if you go on Facebook, you can search that and
yes,
okay,
get in touch with everything and see what's out there.
Okay.
And
well, thank you, ladies.
And I wanted to say, definitely, and people can always reach out to our podcast.
Yeah, you can find us on Spotify and Apple iTunes. You can also find us through our website at www.SheilaInTheGig.com. And you can email us at SheilaInTheGig@gmail.com.
For ideas, questions, sponsorships, you name it.
We can't wait to hear from you.
And everybody have a snazzy Friday. Right? Let's
thanks,
try to make
ladies.
This
thank
let's
you.
Try to yes. make this July matter,
yes.
Right?
It's Concert of Colors night.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, Charles Wright Museum and all kinds of other things, right?
Okay. Yes.
She and a day.